So former English teacher and newspaper editor that I am, I'd like to begin today with a note on grammar, which might also serve as a bit of a disclaimer. I originally titled this sermon, Can I Punch a Nazi? But a friend helpfully pointed out that unless I wanted to give my opinion on people's physical ability to punch a Nazi, I might want to choose a different word. So then I thought, should I punch a Nazi? Or perhaps the more quaint, shall I punch a Nazi? No, that sounds entirely too much like I'm going to give folks a definitive answer, which is way beyond my pay grade. May I punch a Nazi? Now that's better. Our second principle, which is justice, equity, and compassion in human relations, calls us to make choices about our behavior. It is also uncomfortably true that a universal application of this principle can lead to these very ideals being at odds with one another. Exhibit A, may I punch a Nazi? I have to say, if you had told me when I started seminary, lo those many years ago, that I would be in my first ministry settlement up here talking to you and seriously contemplating the theological ramifications of Nazi punching, I would have been skeptical. But I am, and so are my colleagues. I found myself recently involved in a lively discussion of Nazi punching with some of my minister friends, and I am here to tell you, we are taking this question pretty seriously. And I will also tell you that the responses were all over the map, from those who were wholly committed to personal nonviolence, to those who saw punching a Nazi to be a prophetic stance. One belief was that a punch to a Nazi is always justified as self-defense, while others insisted that they don't think they would punch a Nazi unless the Nazi punched first. But all of these differing positions were carefully thought out and, dare I say it, principled. Thank you. For example, there's a big difference between punching someone on the subway or in the grocery store and punching someone wearing white supremacist regalia or Nazi insignia in a public space such as a protest or media event. One is simply an act of interpersonal violence, but the other could be a public act in the public sphere. While I don't think I would ever choose to punch a Nazi who was, as a friend of mine put it, actively humaning, I can imagine a world in which I might punch a Nazi who was, as that same friend said, actively Nazi-ing. It would seem that there are limits to my tolerance. But is tolerance within certain limits tolerance at all? This is one of the questions that is thrown up when we have these serious conversations about who we might punch. Philosopher Karl Popper considered this critical question in a book over 7 decades ago. Important to note, perhaps, for our purposes, Popper, whose family was Jewish, immigrated from Vienna while staring down the barrel of World War II. So he does have some firsthand experience with our topic today. In his text, The Open Society and Its Enemies, he remarks on what he calls the paradox of freedom. What if the free man, or free woman in our case, elects a tyrant? What if a democracy willingly places into power someone who will destroy their freedom? Popper concludes, unlimited tolerance must lead to the disappearance of tolerance. If we extend unlimited tolerance, even to those who are intolerant, if we are not prepared to to defend a tolerant society against the onslaught of the intolerant, then the tolerant will be destroyed and tolerance with them. Now, Popper is not advocating suppressing the intolerant. In his view, we let them speak as society's rational mechanisms and popular opinion will have their way with such bigoted sentiments. And this sometimes works. As we learned from the heroes of our story earlier today, there is more than one way to punch a Nazi. We can also punch a Nazi in the ego. Tolerance has its limits and a fatal flaw, as Popper explained. Because as long as white supremacists can hide behind freedom of speech and claim equal space with those who resist them, that kind of tolerance does not serve justice or equity or compassion, nor does it serve our democracy. Our principles may have limits, may have inherent incompatibilities, because we don't live in a theoretical world. This is not the playground of the mind. We live in this world. And I do believe that the perfect is the enemy of the good. When we interpret our principles as requiring a perfect commitment, I think we wade into dangerous territory, valuing ideas over people and elevating ideological purity over very real harm to human life and dignity. And do you know who elevates ideological purity over very real harm to human life and dignity? Well, for one, Nazis. There is something satisfying, to me anyway, about the idea of punching a Nazi. And I'm going to say punching a Nazi until we are all desensitized, just so you know. Our commitment to debate and to discourse and to hearing each other out can sometimes have us feeling like we're shouting at a brick wall. It is unfortunate but true that when a position rejects fundamental premises such as equity and compassion, its adherents will not be swayed by appeals to such. Nor do facts matter in a debate with someone who willfully ignores them. This is truly infuriating. This anger is real. I feel it myself. So maybe the allure of Nazi punching is about more than just the physical act, but the idea, an expression of sacred anger against another more devastating idea, one that refuses to bow to appeals to reason and to common humanity. Now, true confession time, I have never punched anyone in my life. And barring a circumstance involving self-defense or defense of others, I'm not sure that I would. But if I'm really being honest, I kind of want to punch some Nazis. For me, the attraction lies in the symbolic resonance. What the clowns in Knoxville and the idea of punching Nazis, the symbolic resonance, what those share is a theme of interruption and disruption. As our friend David Shantz challenged us a few weeks ago, I want to not just be an ally, but an accomplice to justice. And that means interrupting violence and calling for genocide and insisting on racial hierarchy are acts of violence, make no mistake. I want to interrupt violence with prophetic witness. And if Jesus can sweep the money changers out of the temple with a whip, it is not beyond my imagination to find punching a Nazi a prophetic possibility. If this is uncomfortable for you, good. It should be uncomfortable. That discomfort in itself makes us perhaps better people, since we'd like violence to never be used. But if someone thinks the end result of creating an uncomfortable culture for Nazis is worth the occasional punch, then they can conclude that punching Nazis can be good. I think we're allowed to celebrate Nazis feeling uncomfortable, even if we're hesitant about the punch. What's unhelpful is equating the punch and the Nazis' discomfort with their ideology itself. For too many, the white supremacy embodied by both traditional historical Nazis and many of the alt-right and white supremacist groups of this day, for too many, those views are merely another opinion, not an inherent threat. So in response, some have equated punching a Nazi with being a Nazi. You're just as bad as they are. Now, it's a moral gymnastic beyond my ability to equate throwing a punch with advocating for the oppression or extermination of a race. The problem for many, and uncomfortably, especially many white people who carry the most privilege in this situation by virtue of sharing a skin tone with the skinheads, for many, civility is about maintaining the status quo. And the status quo is always more comfortable than interrupting systems of oppression. It is also unfortunately true that the status quo in many Western societies is a system that still harms people of color. Any action for justice will, by definition, be disruptive. For those who are comfortable with the status quo, there is no virtue in its disruption. For the rest of us, there is. A punch may be uncivil, but racism is worse. Earlier in the service, I shared the words of a theologian, James Luther Adams, who went to Germany in 1935 to study with some of the great German theologians. While there, he was confronted by a deeply unsettling reality, and that was Germany's churches were not effectively resisting the rise of Nazism. German liberalism had not foreseen the Nazi threat, nor did it seem to offer adequate resources for resistance. One idea appears again and again throughout Adams' writing. Faith is not fundamentally about one's beliefs, but about one's commitments. Find out what someone values the most, and you will have found the object of their faith, whether they consider themselves religious or not. Is it success? Is it the adrenaline rush of crisis? Is it comfort? When our commitments claim more loyalty than they truly deserve, when we sacrifice great things in life to small things, we are living out a corruption of our faith. Authentic faith, on the other hand, grows out of a critical awareness of how our commitments are ultimately related. It is rooted in a person's awareness that they are not God, that their perception is always limited, and their commitments will always need correction and redirection. Adams loved to say, "An unexamined faith is not worth having, for it can be true only by accident." Authentic faith is an examined and self-critical faith. It is when we are asked to choose between competing concerns that we know something real is at stake. To choose between two goods is where the rubber meets the road in a self-examined faith. Must my commitment to nonviolence be absolute in order to be real? Is my commitment to nonviolence more important than my commitment to disrupt and resist oppression and ideologies of violence? In the principal song that we learned last week, the line for the second principle is, "Be kind in all you do." But kind to whom? It's not especially kind to punch a Nazi, at least not to that particular Nazi. But any and all disruption of white supremacy is a kindness to an act of solidarity with those targeted by its rhetoric and actions, which seems like the kindness with which I wish to be concerned. At my ordination last December, Reverend Joanna Crawford delivered this sermon and reminded us that what is most central to our faith is our commitment to upholding human life and dignity. As an accomplice to social change, as an accomplice to building a world that is more just, more equitable, and more compassionate, my commitment is to upholding human life and dignity. At the end of the day, the question I must ask myself is not, were my morals pure? The question I will ask myself is, did I do all I could? So should you punch a Nazi? You tell me. But may you punch a Nazi? In the words of another friend and colleague, there are many paths to the Almighty, and some of them involve punching Nazis. Please join me in our closing hymn, Everyday People.